You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul Bloom.
Hello, Robert Wright. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. And by the way, I'm Robert Wright of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Bloom of the Small Potatoes Newsletter, famous psychologist at the University of Toronto. And you know, it's funny that you should be in Canada, Paul, because I woke up this morning with a burning desire to move to Canada. I can't quite articulate why.
Something made
me want to get out of America. I don't know what it was.
Has there been news? There's been news.
I haven't checked the newspapers yet.
I think we have a marvelous opportunity for counter programming where we don't discuss the election at all, but we discuss movies we've enjoyed over time, TV shows, fashion.
Paul, I'm afraid that there's only one thing on my mind, and that's the election.
And you're talking about the American election, not the Canadian one, which is
not the Canadian one.
It hasn't been called yet, but we'll talk about it.
I was actually going to ask you. This is relevant to last night's election in America, which didn't go as I had hoped.
Should we provide people with background? So the election happened last night and Trump won decisively.
Yeah, that's for those who didn't know. That's helpful background. Thank you.
Good.
And Donald Trump, should we tell them who Trump is?
Donald J. Trump.
Used to be in real estate, reality TV star. I had an uneventful 4 years as president before, I would say. So I'm looking forward to another.
Somebody on Twitter described him as a rascal. And the response was, he's more of a scallywag.
Those are both perhaps a little too
harsh
kind.
Terms.
But I was wondering, how does this look from a Canadian point? Like, do people in Canada say, what is it with America and this Trump thing? Or do they say, we're just one election away because this, we're looking at global trends, tectonic shifts in politics, and right-wing populism is the thing everywhere, and it could happen here. What do they say?
Yeah, you're kind of asking the wrong guy because I'm a university professor in Canada, so all my friends have the politics you'd expect. They're all either Americans or they went to America for grad school and so on. So everyone is, there's several feelings. Everyone's sort of, everybody I talked to is rather appalled by the way it turned out, this really landslide for Trump and taking the Senate and I guess the House possibly.
I think they probably will take the House, yeah. I mean, it's not a landslide like in olden times
where you would have
60-40, like, you know, Nixon McGovern or something.
Yeah.
But by recent standards, I mean, it's unusual for a Republican president to win both the, you know, to win not only the Electoral College, but the popular vote.
That's
and
right.
He did that. But I mean, really, the margins are actually pretty slender in the popular vote. I don't know what the final tally is.
It's like a percentage point. It's that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty narrow, right? And that's, I mean, one thing I would say. Maybe I've interrupted you, but
you don't want to drift too far away from Canada.
Oh yeah, let's stay with Canada. That's much more interesting.
Let's get the listeners what they want, which is Canadian
politics. I think they came here for the Canadian ambiance. Yes.
So serious sentiment that thank God we're in Canada. I mean, shit's going to happen where you are, and maybe it will actually affect people's lives. We're somewhat insulated by that, but of course, nobody's fully insulated from what happens in the United States, and our economy tends to be in lockstep with the U.S.'s economy and so on. We have, our prime minister, Justin Trudeau, is incredibly unpopular. The betting markets have him losing by, I think, like 99% when election is called. And he'll lose to the conservative, Pierre Poilievre. And Poilievre is kind of a Trumpian figure in certain ways. But the truth is, he's not really. He's you know, he has liberal views about you know, our healthcare system, which is fine. He's pro-choice. He's pro-gay marriage. His immigration views don't differ substantially from Trudeau's. He's kind of into crypto. He wants to lower federal spending. But he's by no, we have no, there's no analogy to Trump in Canada.
No, well, why do people even say he's Trumpist? He sounds like kind of like a conservative plus crypto.
Yeah. He has
not even conservative by American standards, just Canadian.
In some ways, he has a Trumpian style. He has, and he's a little bit culture war. very into free speech and concerned about the Trudeau government's repression of free speech. Fast on his feet, kind of a bit aggressive, sometimes a bit goofy. But mm-hmm. but it's the Canadian version of a demagogue, which is not a demagogue at all.
Right. Yeah, well, we have a real one. Yeah. This one goes to 11. It's not great. Yeah.
You said something wise. Can we begin with this? You said something
sure.
wise.
Sure, remind me when I say it.
It was in your newsletter. It was right before an election. And it was something about not panicking. And I got to admit, well, you said something wise and they stopped reading. Because he says, okay, quit while I'm at it. But you described the election between Obama and Romney and said you were rooting for Obama, as I was. But, you know, if Romney had won, there'd be a different direction of history, obviously. And almost certainly there'd be no Trump. You know, he'd probably reach the second term, but it would foreclose the future we're now living in. And the point of what you're saying is that it's really hard to predict the future. It is for people who see a sort of straight line extrapolation, either me and most of my friends and you, we're all going to hell now, or a lot of the people I see on X, you know, Ben Shapiro, Elon Musk, these are the glory days. We're headed off into this Trumpian paradise. Everybody's going to be wrong. It's going to be unpredictable. And that should be a form of solace for those of us who think that this has been a truly, it is a truly terrible future we're heading into. Nobody knows.
Yeah, well, that was the point I made. I mean, this is part of a little video sermonette I sent out to subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which anyone can become, by the way. And it actually, you know, it actually did better than I thought, like on YouTube. It was pretty well received by my, you know, modest standards. And part of the idea was, so it was right before the election. I was saying, you know, whatever happens, you never really know what the long-term ramifications will be. I gave the Romney example where I was dead set against Romney, but in retrospect, if he had won, he would have been the Republican incumbent in 2016. Probably no Donald Trump on the political scene. And that is a generally true fact. Now, I then proceeded to say something that was kind of meant to be comparably consoling in a way, but like wasn't really when you, and that was just that, you know, it's funny, like a lot of us woke up, you know, and Trump won and some people on my side were like, oh my God, just what kind of country do we live in? I can't believe it. And I thought, well, you already knew what kind of, knew we live in a country where half of the country wants Trump to be president. That's the situation. Turns out it's 51% rather than 49, but that's nothing. Yeah. And that's the other thing I said is that even if the Democrats had won, we would face this long-term problem of a deeply polarized nation. And half of it is, you know, the red state part. Feels for whatever reason that it's willing to invest in people like Donald Trump to get its business done, which, you know, disturbs me a little. I'm not among those who just can't comprehend it. You know, all three of my siblings voted for Trump. There was a fourth, but all three of my living siblings voted for Trump. And so I don't denigrate them. I will say, first of all, it does, like, people I know who are like super well educated and so on, and I'm not going to mention Mickey Kouse's name, but that, you know, when they support Trump, I have a little more trouble wrapping my mind around it. I mean, in the election, early in the evening, before we knew how things were going to swing, Trump tweeted, I'm already hearing about dirty business in Philadelphia vote counting. And I just thought, this is the kind of guy this is. He knows he doesn't have any actual evidence of that, but he's already in the business of deciding that if he doesn't win, he's going to tear the country apart. Okay. I just don't, again, I know a lot of people who just aren't in the business of watching politics. And I understand the support for Trump. And I want to say more about why I understand it. But the growing number of, I guess you could say, elites who are just fine with the various things about Trump that would have been disqualifying, I think, 20, 30, 40 years ago in America, I don't totally get. So.
Yeah, I my understanding from the how things turned out is that Trump gained votes across all these different constituent groups, like for men, for women, for blacks, for whites, for Hispanics. Is that true? It was like across the board, he did better.
He did better than he had done. He didn't. Yeah. He did. You know. Yeah.
He didn't. Obviously, he like for blacks, he fell way behind.
He did better than
the
Republicans had done with blacks, Hispanics. Certainly better than he had done. Yeah. Which, you know, well, I mean, there's a group of us on the blue state side who have long wished the Democratic Party would start thinking of this more in terms of economic class. And to me, this validates this. Yeah. And, you know, in a way, it's good news if ethnicities aren't voting as blocks. I mean, really, in a certain sense, the most dangerous thing for a country in the long term can be bitter polarization between ethnic groups. OK. Yeah. And that's, if anything, less the case this election than last election. So that's kind of good news. Because it's easier to start a true violent civil war between ethnic groups than it is, you know, between red state, blue state, especially when actually each state is split maybe 55-45. There is no big clear geographic civil war type divide in America.
Yeah. But the reason why I'm raising that is it sort of short circuits any of a sort of reductive view of the sort that, uneducated white men are to blame for all of this, while the rest of the country stood strong against Trump. And it's more complicated than that.
A lot more. Yeah. I mean, for one thing, you had a lot of rich, smart guys get behind Trump, especially from Silicon Valley, very conspicuously. Yeah, that was more respectable thing to do, apparently, this time around than last time. And I mean, that's a small number of people. But they
are powerful.
Very powerful. I mean, we're about to become, people can argue about whether we were already an oligarchy. We were certainly a plutocracy, but we are about to be closer to an oligarchy than ever. I mean, keep your eye on Elon Musk. He's going to have a ridiculous amount of power. He already does, by leave aside, being in the good graces of the White House, which he is now. So keep your eyes peeled.
So I'm going to ask you to do some punditry, but I've been like reading a lot of really bad punditry this morning. So I want you to do the good sort. So the bad sort, which it's incredibly predictable. I have friends of mine who are really into DEI. They're very upset about the diversity movement universe. And they say, this is why Trump won, because everyone's pissed off at this. I know people who are upset about who are concerned that there's gender bias. Trump won because Harris is a woman. People get upset. I read this guy saying what really did it for Trump, what really led Trump to win, was when Jared Kushner was interviewed by Lex Fridman. And people saw that he was a kind of reasonable guy. And that turned the tables. I haven't even heard of this. So I'll ask you the sort of punditry question. Who should we blame?
Well, I'll say first of all,
what I mean from the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll start at the micro level in terms of individual people I'd like to blame. First of all, after this result, I no longer believe that like almost any randomly selected Democrat other than Kamala could have won, but I still believe a lot of them could have won. And I think, so you got to ask like, how did she become the candidate? First of all, I blame Joe Biden for not being self-aware enough to get the hell out of the race more than a year ago and let there just be a primary.
That's the right answer. Biden has the most to blame as any individual for this, for not getting out of the race.
Or Jill even. You know, it's hard to admit to yourself that you're getting super old, but he was clearly getting super old a year ago, year and a half ago. Right. I was saying we have to, elites like Obama have to figure out a way to get him out of the race. I had specific scenarios. I had plans. It was obvious.
No, you were ahead of the game with the eject Biden.
As so moment. Often, Paul. As so often.
Never listened to, but a prophet, but not respected in his own house.
A prophet is without honor in his home country, to paraphrase another prophet. A slight adjustment. Where was I? Who are we blaming? Okay, so blame Biden, blame Jill. I mean, and there's two reasons Kamala is a bad candidate, by the way. One is she's tied to the administration, and rightly or wrongly, a plurality of voters think they are worse off than they were when Biden came into office. And I think there's a general feeling of just kind of dislocation and instability. We got these two raging kind of wars going on that the U.S. is involved with and that Biden doesn't seem capable of ending. And you got various things going on domestically. Inflation was high for the first part of his term, even though it's lower now. On balance, the economic numbers don't look so bad now, but for whatever reason, people didn't feel good about an incumbent, and Kamala has comes from the administration. So that's bad. And then B, she's just a bad candidate. I mean, I think, you know, she gives a good speech, and you and I agreed that during the debate, she did a good job of like giving her little set pieces, but she's not good at thinking on her feet. She's basically a jukebox. It's like there's a finite number of songs. You press the button, the song comes out. And if you press a button that doesn't correspond to a song, you're gonna get a song that doesn't correspond to the button you press. But first, you might get a little deer in the headlights action because she doesn't think well on her feet. And I think maybe she's a little risk averse. And one of the problems is she's afraid she'll say the wrong thing. But for whatever reason, she didn't come off well. You look at the polls when she first showed up on the scene and people saw, oh, she smiles, she's articulate, gives a great speech. Her numbers were a lot better. But the more they got to know her, the worse the numbers got. So anyway, she's a bad candidate. And I blame all the Democrats who are saying, well, gosh, after the trauma of dumping Biden, we can't possibly have an open convention. Well, couldn't have come out much worse than this. And I was certainly for one. I was not for Kamala being the candidate. But all that said, I would say there may be some virtue for the Democrats in having kind of lost resoundingly. And I think, again, there are candidates who wouldn't have lost resoundingly. There are candidates who would have won. But we got one who lost about as resoundingly as a candidate could have lost, I think, any of the likely candidates. And it gets back to what you're saying, like, what about DEI? What about the issues? What should Democrats change? I mean, this is, I think, going to, you would think, lead to a kind of reckoning in the way the 2016 election didn't, because that was like, blame the Russians, which, you know, some people will try to do again, God knows. And also just see Trump as this weird thing that stormed on the stage. We'll get rid of him. This nightmare will be over. There's nothing deeper going on in the body politic. And I think, you know, now Democrats will, do some rethinking. Let me ask you a question. So to get to the kind of DEI woke issues. If you could change one thing about the Democrats' position on the trans issue, what would it be?
Oh, I personally, I'd love to see polling that asks the question whether this matters, as opposed to it matters to a small group of people on both sides who've taken it incredibly important. But did that play a big role? But because, you know, the obvious thing is the economy and immigration and nothing to do with trans issues. And those are really important issues. But to answer your question, I think that the reasonable liberal attitude is to say, look, we support trans people. We support the rights of trans people. We support their freedoms. We are virulently against people who discriminate against them. But there are complicated issues involving trans people in sports that are just genuinely complicated. And it's not like, oh, obviously, anybody who questions the issue of trans people in sports is this terrible transphobe and a monster. But, you know, these are difficult moral issues, and we'll struggle with it. And well, so I think that that is a perfectly good liberal claim. I think it's true. I think there's at least some people who, although in an objective sense, it's such a tiny issue, but they get really upset about what they see as biological men cheating and getting prizes that women should have won. And it's this tiny issue in an objective sense, but some people take it very seriously.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. On the trans issue, if there's one thing that I think probably strikes most of the people who get upset about this as crazy, it's that. And it's like, I mean, I'm not sure it's that difficult an issue by convince. I mean, they have a pretty, you know, they have a pretty strong argument. On the other hand, I think there are philosophical frameworks within which this becomes a very difficult issue. You ask basic questions about, well, what is advantage in sports? What is unfair? All that's very interesting. But the one predictable thing is that obviously most people, and certainly people who have daughters who compete in sports,
yeah,
are going to say, what the fuck are you talking about? The idea, why even have women's sports if someone who went through puberty as a male and has basically male musculature can compete in that category? The whole idea of the category is it's for people who don't have those characteristics, right? I mean,
yeah.
I'm not particularly embracing that argument. Again, it depends on which philosophical assumptions you want to make. But it just seems obvious to me that that's the way it's going to strike most people forevermore. And so I don't, you know, and yet it is official Biden policy. I believe the way they've handled, what is it, Title IX? You know, you have to let them compete in the women's division. Now, that's going to change because Trump can just reverse it, I guess, yeah. Right? And so that probably will be a non-issue next time. And I'm guessing that no Democratic candidate is say, I will change it back. Very few. I think that's probably off the table. That particular aspect of the trans issue.
So do you think... I'm honestly curious about this. Do you think it mattered? Now, in some sense, everything matters. I mean, Joe Rogan's endorsement matters. Everything pushes some people one way or another. But do you think it made a substantive difference as part of the reason why Trump won?
I don't know. You know, I'm not in a swing state. I was not blanketed with ads. Well, I don't watch. We cut the cord anyway. I don't watch cable TV. But, and I guess I'm not identified by my browser as somebody who should see many political ads, apparently. I just didn't see many. But I'm told that there were a lot of these ads targeted at certain demographics. And you just see the appeal. Now, no, I mean, there are a lot of other issues as well. I mean, there's certainly immigration. There's other aspects of DEI. And here, you know, Kamala had the misfortune of being someone that heartfelt, you know, ardent opponents of everything DEI could just look at and say, you embody DEI. You are yourself a product of DEI, right? That was the way they looked at it. And there
was a story which came out about a week ago. And I have no idea how much this moved a needle. But the story was when she assumed her position as vice president, she has access to these intelligence briefings. And she immediately seized upon the fact that female leaders were described using different adjectives than male leaders.
Yeah,
made it her top priority. And in some way, most people, you know, I guess that matters, but if that's the big thing for her, it presents it as a caricature of the woke liberal who cares more about the proper language you use than actually, you know, honest to God, important intelligence issues.
Yeah, I thought that was evidence that the New York Times is not 100% in the tank for Democrats.
Yeah, it was not a good thing for them to
release. It was a Times story, and it was very prominent. It was like the lead. It was like on the, you know, front page, home page. It was like, Kamala, this is, you know, you give her some influence on foreign policy. What does she do with it? It's like, do we have our pronouns right? You know, that's the kind of caricature that emerges from that. And no, that didn't help. And look. Well, yeah. There's so many mysteries. Why did she go so on foreign policy, so hawkish in so many ways? I think that represents a fundamental misreading of what Trump. I, or failure to see what Trump, I think, demonstrated the first time around, 2016, is that most Americans don't, you know, they to a large extent don't give a shit about foreign policy, and they just don't feel particularly enthusiastic about America going around and getting involved in a bunch of conflicts. And you know, the big moment was when Trump ridiculed John McCain, and everybody's going, oh, he's done. Trump's done in American politics. You can't do that. Oh, actually, turns out you can. People just don't, you know, McCain was a war hero, but tough luck.
So I'm more positive in Kamala than you are. I kind of agree with everything you said about her strengths and her weaknesses. But and maybe somebody else could have done better. But once it was her, she did a couple of things. Things which you pointed out. She gives a good speech. She gets a crowd going. She destroyed Trump in a debate, which is not nothing. I think it led to a boost in popularity, a drop in Trump's popularity. Trump was afraid to debate her again. So it's really something. And she ran a very low risk campaign. It was purposely low risk. Waltz is a low risk person to bring out. He doesn't offend anybody. No dirt on him. No problem. Not like Shapiro, you know, who would have enraged the left and would have got free speech issues going and so on. She was very safe. She tried to avoid doing interviews until she had to do them, and then she didn't do them well. But it's not obvious. It's in retrospect, sure, she failed. But at the time, if somebody said ahead of time, she's going to run a low-risk campaign where she's just going to say, I'm a normal centrist person who will be a fine president and don't elect a fascist, I'd say that's not bad.
Yeah, I thought maybe she shouldn't have let herself be intimidated into departing from the low-risk strategy, even to the extent that she did, which is to say, do interviews with, you know, not just assuredly friendly people. I mean, she did an interview on Fox. She did some interviews that, and, you know, she often did not come off well. I mean,
you think she should have gone on Rogan?
I don't know. I mean, in retrospect, sure. Now that I know what happened.
In retrospect, she should have anything different. Yeah. But yeah, the Rogan's a three-hour interview with a guy who's strange, not as hostile as a Fox, you know, interviewer, but hostile enough.
He is generally friendly.
Yeah, he's friendly.
He's a kind of naturally friendly person. He has strong views, but you know, he comes off as a friendly interviewer.
He'd probably try to get her to smoke a joint with him.
And she'd say, are you kidding? I'm Jamaican. You know, that's how she answered the one. Anyway, would have been interesting. But again, I think she genuinely fears having to sit there and think on her feet. She's afraid of a lot of impromptu conversation. I think she really is. And it wouldn't, I don't think it would have gone well, because now it may be that if you could just give her like a Xanax or something, and it turns out that her whole problem is risk aversion. If she relaxes, she's this, you know, engaging conversationalist, which I think may be the case.
Yeah.
Then maybe it would have made sense. But if we were going to see the Kamala we saw, which is just like, it's the jukebox, she's got these set speeches. Yeah. No, that would not have helped.
I have to say though, I thought up until the end, I thought she's doing well. She's doing all the right things. She's risk averse, but I get it. It was only at the very end I started to think, like right before I started thinking, oh shit, 50-50 and probably Trump will win. But the outcome was a surprise to me, at least.
I thought she did well given her skill set, honestly. I mean, she's not a great candidate. She worked hard. She prepped well for the debate, did well. And all of that. And look, she was not helped by Joe Biden. You know, that last thing where he says Trump's followers are garbage.
Yeah.
That may have had a non-trivial impact. That was like a one-man get out the vote, operation for Trump. Right. Because I thought the garbage outfit thing by Trump was probably brilliant, because it's going to go on all known media. It's going to remind his followers of what Joe Biden said about them. And, you know, that was seriously screwed up on Biden. I mean, it's more evidence. Whatever else you conclude, Biden definitely should not have been the candidate.
There's like an iron law of American politics that sooner or later a Democrat says something where they smear their opponents in that, exactly that way. Garbage, deplorables, Obama was clinging to their guns and religion. These little things which really affect people. There's nothing like thinking that the other party, those people, don't respect you.
Well, Trump does that.
Trump calls them animals. And
yeah, I mean, Republicans started decades ago. I think Dan Quayle was the first, you know, when he was vice president, ran for the presidency. I guess he didn't get past the primaries, right? He was never on the ticket, I think. But he was vice president. And he was the one who started using the phrase cultural elite to refer to like Democrats and liberals. They were these coastal elites who were really not, in some sense, not Americans. That was that was the idea. And then that has really gotten ramped up over time. And now it's become like a fundamental framing. These coastal elites, out of touch. And look, I think there's a certain amount of truth to it. And that's why I think there's some value in them taking a good drumming here and having to, now, will they rethink? I think they need to rethink a little on things like immigration. And as I said, you know, some at the margins, some of the DEI issues, which are often rhetorical issues anyway.
Yeah, they're culture war stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, regarding immigration, as always, the U.S., the question that people are asking is, what's Canada up to? And Trudeau, our prime minister, has very publicly said he's slowing down illegal immigration to Canada over the next couple of years by about 20%. Because Canada, among other things, has a housing crisis. And he says we've got to sort of slow down the influx of people. A lot of people come into the country over the last many years. And it's not inconceivable for a party, for the left party, the Liberal Party, to do that kind of thing, to get some sort of control over it.
Well, Canada uses a system, I think, that some Trumpists are advocating, the point-based system, where it's basically a way of bringing in wealthy and well-educated people, right? And nobody else.
Yeah. I mean, there's a million different categories, you know, students and you know, family members and so on. But it really is interesting because this is the very liberal government and we're a pretty liberal country. But it is the system that the Democrats would often view as this is horrible. This is, you know, nativist and racist and the Republicans like. But it's a different system and it works. I think it works pretty well. I know in Canada there's issues of just in some way for our country overpopulation, given the sort of small space that we actually live in as opposed to the giant space of our country, and so we're slowing things down. But we don't have the same immigration isn't this hot but an ugly issue.
Of course, the bad news is now you have citizens that the government of India tries to assassinate. But aside from that,
that's true.
You know, you let a few controversial figures through the net apparently, but. You know, they were, if people don't know, the government of India apparently was trying to assassinate somebody in Canada who was associated with Sikh separatism or something.
It's very un-Canadian.
So go ahead.
Well, I was gonna ask you, which thing I'm honestly interested in. I mean, as everybody should be, but of all the things that Trump has promised, mass deportation, having RFK Jr. handle water and vaccines and health, tariffs, 20% tariffs on all countries. What do you think he's going to do?
It's a good question. I mean, I think what he said about tariffs is 10 to 20%. I'm sure people will try to talk him out of that, including probably some, I don't know, maybe some people like Elon Musk who have real sway with him, but certainly some mainstream Republican economists would like to talk him out of it. That'll be highly inflationary. I mean, I don't know when the last time I bought an article of clothing or pair of shoes that was made in the United States. Okay. So he's talking about a 10% tax on all of that and a lot of electronics and stuff. And, you know, it hits the people he purports to represent the hardest, of course. A consumption tax, which is the kind of rough equivalent of, hurts lower and middle income people more than the rich people.
to be fair to Trump, and I've heard somebody, it's another high profile Republican say, look, he doesn't really mean this. This is meant to be sort of an opening salvo against other countries with their tariffs to say, look, we'll tariff you. So, you know, this is a threat that he hopes not to instantiate, which might be true.
Maybe he'll do that. I mean, that's not the way he put it, I think, but maybe he will say, okay, I'm going to unveil this in 6 months and countries can right. come tell me what concessions they'll make on their own tariffs in exchange for not being hit. Who knows?
That's right.
On the other stuff, I don't know. I mean, on immigration...
I don't know if there's any appetite for the mass deportations.
I'm sure you can find people who voted for him, but I think most people would settle for, and certainly would have settled for from Biden, just much tighter control of the border. And I mean, I've always said, there's nothing wrong with tight control of your border. What bothered me about Trump was how, the first time around, he was, being inhumane toward people who are already in the United States. Yes, yeah. They may have come here illegally, but they did that at a time wherever everybody just like with a nod and a wink said, everybody does it. Come on in. You actually line up outside of Home Depot every day. And every cop who drives by knows you're an illegal immigrant. You're waiting to be picked up by some construction company and paid for the day and some contractor. And that's the way it's done in America. And these people came over with that understanding. And, you know, to now suddenly make them live in fear, I just think is deeply inhumane. And I still do. I don't like the symbolism of a wall. But in general, if Trump can, if he can find a way to enforce the laws at the border, I don't have an objection to enforcing immigration laws in that way. But
yeah. I mean, the ugly part of it is the ugliness of the rhetoric associated with it. You know, the cats yeah. and the dog sort of thing. They're rapists or killers, which is just straight out, textbook ugly dehumanizing rhetoric against a group of people.
No, he's just full of that kind of stuff. And we've lost track of it. And to get back to the fact that, I mean, again, having several siblings who voted for Trump, I'm not sure how any of them voted this time around. I'm not optimistic, but I don't know for sure.
Thanksgiving's coming up.
No, we don't. They don't live anywhere near me. Okay. I see them every 2 years at a reunion we have. But we've learned long ago. We don't talk about this stuff. On the subject of what a horrible human being he is, when I thought he was toast the first time around was when he made fun of a disabled person, a handicapped person, or whatever the appropriate term is. And by the way, I really would encourage liberals to just relax on whether handicapped or disabled is the right. I mean, this is the kind of thing that energizes Trump's base, and it just doesn't matter. Lecturing people on, when they just mean well and they don't, and neither of them, neither term has inherently worse connotations or anything.
But let me just jump in on a defense of Kamala, which is that she never did that. She really downplayed this. The idea that she'd be the first woman president was something, as far as I know, she never uttered and didn't allow Waltz to utter. She was very sensitive to this issue of not appearing to be a scold, not appearing to be a language police, not even appearing to adopt any form of identity politics.
Yeah. No, and on the gender issue, I think she was more better than Hillary Clinton in that regard.
Yeah,
Hillary's very much about I'm not a huge Hillary fan, but what I was going to say was, so it was just horrible. I don't know if you remember, he got up on stage and he kind of mimicked the guy.
I've seen a video. Yeah,
and if you ask, well, how could people vote for that guy? Which I asked, the answer is a lot of them don't think he did that. And you have to remember that we're just living in different media ecosystems. They, like you say, how could they vote for Donald Trump? And you have to remember, they're not voting for Donald Trump you see on your social media feed.
Yeah.
They're voting for a different sanitized Donald Trump. And then some of the things you'd both agree he did, they forgive him for, or they take them as sarcasm, joking, and so on. You don't. But anyway, on this. So after he did that, his team made up this like fake video. Okay. So he made a point of going out on stage and saying, I forget who he was making fun of, like Ted Cruz, somebody wasn't handicapped, and doing the same thing. And then they, and so then they put out this video going, oh, they're, you know, the liberals are lying to you. See, Donald Trump does this with lots of people who aren't handicapped. It's just something he does. And it was a complete lie. He only did that after the fact. But my point is, you know, he gave people who wanted to believe he wasn't a horrible person a reason to believe that. And we're all eager to believe the best of people that we otherwise want to support. And
there's some situations where there's different ways of interpreting it. And actually, the Trump side is correct. So there's the famous line, some good people on both sides, which was used against them in the debate by Harris, was used by Obama, even though I'm certain they both fully well know that from the context of it, you see, he was very clearly not talking about the white supremacists who are marching. He's explicit about this.
And he explicitly disavows that. Yes, yeah. No, you're right. I wrote about
this.
And
Trump started to sputter about it during the debate. But he was right. Now, there's the 1,000 other things that Trump did, which were horrible. But when you lie about some of these things, people reasonably enough says maybe you're lying about the rest.
Yeah. No, and this drove him crazy. It's called the, I'm blanking on the town in Virginia. The, it'll come to
you.
The Charlottesville lie, they call it. And you know, and you know, he's kind of a master at this, I think he sometimes, he says things and you can just tell he knows that the liberal media is going to go berserk and oversimplify what he said and slightly mischaracterize it. And then he can turn to his followers and go, they said I wanted to execute Lynn Cheney. I didn't say I wanted to execute Lynn Cheney.
Yeah,
and he didn't, but I think he was trolling us.
Yeah, he's a professional troll, and his followers, to some extent, aren't dopes. They see he's transgressive, he's funny, he's a joker.
Yeah,
and they get that, and his jokes can be cruel, and his shtick could be incomprehensible, but. In some way, he doesn't take himself seriously. I'm sure we talked about this before.
Well, that's funny because he's, of course, in some ways a narcissist and ultimately one, I think. But
he's also the consummate bullshitter in Frankfurt's sense of he doesn't give a shit about whether he's telling the truth or lying. It's just not, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, you almost think he has to, you would think he would have to think these things he says about himself are taken as a joke. How often has he said, no one has ever seen anything like this, referring to a crowd of his or something? And it's just obviously, he just, you know, not true, but
somebody come up to me and said, sir, you're the best president there has ever been, sir.
Yeah.
And then someone else said, you're the best president of my lifetime, sir. And that got me really mad because he was only 40. So what's he talking about? I'm the best president ever. And, you know.
Those are jokes.
Those are jokes, I guess.
That's a joke, I think. But,
It's not as if we're not going to have this man occupying so much of our life for the next 4 years. This is of all the things, immigration, abortion rights, and so on, that really matter to people. I am stuck up on this small thing that it's so fucking annoying to have Trump all the time now.
Yeah, well, that's part of my reaction is just, oh, do I have to deal with this guy for 4 years? Now I have to deal with Elon Musk, too. He's going to be insufferable.
You think he's going to get a cabinet position?
Well, I think Trump has said he's going to create some probably informal, you know, efficiency czar thing. And that's what I mean when I say we're talking serious oligarchy. It's like, Musk, you know, gave him well over $100 million for his, to his super PAC, did a ton of other shit for him, censored anti-Trump stuff on Twitter. That's a fact, demonstrably. You know, and in return, I think he may get whatever executive power there is in the way of like axing agencies and reducing their budgets. Yeah. And, you know, Musk has his grievances against various government agencies. And so could get ugly. We should probably go to that very special place that's accessible only to people who are paid subscribers, either to your newsletter, Small Potatoes, or to my newsletter, Non-Zero. I would say quickly, like my short-term political goal, get the Senate back in 2 years, ideally before any Supreme Court justices have been appointed, and to at least minimize the number of federal judges he appoints. Because I think that's genuinely dangerous. Yeah. Now he knows what he's doing. Yep. He's going to appoint just straight-up loyalists as judges, and I think he's done some of that already, but... And it may turn out that the Republicans having the House actually makes it easier for the Democrats to take back the Senate. I mean, we'll see. It's a long story. Yeah. We can talk about that in overtime, as we call it. But first, we should encourage everyone to smash the like button, rate and review us, and become paid subscribers, or the euphemism of your choice. We call them members, non-zero members.
We call them taters.
You call them tater heads.
That's a good callback to Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, and Mr. Potato Head, a big part of my childhood. Well, when I was a boy, we used actual potatoes for Mr. Potato Head, Paul. But by your time, they were probably plastic, weren't they?
Plastic, yeah.
Yep.
And now the kids today probably just have AI potatoes.
Digital potatoes. Kids, you can't eat digital potatoes. We'll explain that in overtime.
There we go.
Okay, so thanks, everybody. If you go to one of those newsletters, you'll find the rest of this.